All right, so this topic has absolutely nothing to do with what I talked about 3 years ago at the same event. You'll notice that my questions in the program are related to the old topic, not this one, because I wasn't on the ball enough. But anyway, we'll go with this. So I'm going to talk primarily about neural networks and deep learning today. So if we take a look at the literature in cryo-EM around deep learning, there actually were a couple of papers back in 2001, 2002, like using neural networks for particle picking. There was some self-organizing map stuff from Jose Maria's group. And then there was a gap, and then more recently, over the last couple of years, there have been some new papers emerging in this area. And really, in that gap, what happened was this one paper by Hinton, sort of the famous paper which introduced the concept of deep learning, which basically said that you could train these very, very large neural networks very efficiently. And this sort of rebirthed the whole field of neural networks, which had been sort of not accomplishing very much at that point in time. And it took a little while for it to gain momentum and come up to speed, but the field is now obviously growing in leaps and bounds. I'm going to start with my acknowledgement slide, so I make sure I don't forget it and get out of the way. I'm going to show some example tomograms during the talk. None of the tomograms I'm going to show you relate to their actual original biological goals, and some of them remain unpublished. So I'm not doing very complete acknowledgements here, but I'm at least trying to acknowledge the people who collected the data. These were all done in collaboration with Hua before he made his journey to Stanford. Muyuan and Michael are my two students. Muyuan just graduated, so he's now a postdoc and beginning to look around for other opportunities. So most of the neural network stuff that I'm going to show you today is Muyuan's work. Basically, when he was a first-year grad student, he went over and took a class in deep learning at Rice, and he came back and said, "Wow, neural networks are really exciting. I want to do something with them. What can we do with them?" So we brainstormed and said, what a good problem. Well, we're not going to use it for 3D reconstruction. We're not going to use it for determining particle orientation. Well, we really like to do some tomogram segmentation. You know, there are no good algorithms for doing that. Why don't we try that as a first topic? So that was finally now just published in Nature Methods just a month or two ago. So let's just introduce the concept first. So this is just a little tour. I mean, we've seen things like this already at this meeting, but this is just a little tour of a section of a PC12 cell. Note, of course, that the circle you see around the outside there isn't the edge of the cell. It's the hole in the carbon. So this is just a little piece of a neurite from a PC12 cell. So the first thing that you want to do when you're looking at these things from a qualitative perspective is you want to annotate all of the various features that are around inside the cell. So we'll just take a little tour of the cell, and then we'll get on to the annotation. So we can annotate, there we go, mitochondria. We can annotate vesicles. We can annotate microtubules. All sorts of things we could pull out of the cell. And then once we've annotated, say, if we annotate all the ribosomes, we might want to then go back and then pull them out of the cell and then do some sort of subtomogram averaging or something like that. So this is the problem. And the current approach that's generally used for solving this sort of problem is some person sitting in front of a computer going slice by slice through, you know, their giant 4K by 4K by 1K tomograms and annotating all of the features using some sort of tools. Now, there are automated tools which are good at identifying specific features. There are pretty good tools for specifically for linear features or specifically for blob-like things, you know, ribosomes or something like that. But there aren't very good tools which allow you to annotate just about anything. So this is where we're trying to go with neural networks. So before I get into the details of the approach, and I'll talk about a little bit about some of the what the other groups are doing as well, let's just look at neural networks. Not too many people have really gotten into what changed when we went from the original concept of neural networks into deep learning. So a lot of you may have seen something like this before, which is just a standard feed-forward neural network. You have some input layer, and basically this means 8 different numbers, which then feed through a set of connections to another layer, so-called hidden layer, Then there's another set of connections and another layer and another set of connections and so on until you get to the output layer. And then this is a set of four numbers, which is the result. Now, obviously, eight numbers isn't a whole lot if we're talking about an image. There's a lot more inputs than that. Now, even with something at the level of 8 pixels, each of these connections going from one neuron here to all of the neurons here has a weight associated with it. And we can represent those weights as a matrix. So if we have 8 neurons in this layer and 8 neurons in this layer, then we need a 64-value matrix, an 8x8 matrix, to represent all of the necessary weights for all of the connections between the layers. Now, if we have several layers, each of those layers is represented by a matrix. And technically, if all we were doing was this weighting process, we could just multiply all those matrices together and take our however deep the network was and collapse it down to a single layer. Mathematically, that would be equivalent. So there's obviously some trick involved. And the trick involved is the fact that in addition to having this weighted connection between layers, there is also an activation function. Okay, this concept was drawn from neurons, and the original activation functions that were used in neural networks back in the 1980s were actually modeled on the activation functions of neurons in the brain. And they were sigmoidal functions, and they were kind of complicated, and they took a long time, computationally speaking, to deal with. Well, one of the big simplifications that's taken place over the recent years is the realization that all you have to do is introduce some sort of nonlinearity. You don't have to introduce a really complicated nonlinearity. You can actually, let's try that again. There we go. You don't actually have to introduce a very complicated nonlinearity. You can actually, if you make the network deep enough, a very simple nonlinearity introduced in each layer can combine to produce an arbitrary amount of nonlinearity in a large network. So the only thing that you're doing here is you have a bias, so you shift the value by some amount, and then you put it through this functional form, which is basically zero, and then past the threshold, it's linear. So the simplest possible sort of nonlinearity. And with this, if you have enough layers, you can represent any sort of nonlinear function. It's mathematically proven that you can represent anything. And due to the simplicity of this nonlinearity that was introduced, you can also then prove that you can take an arbitrarily deep network and use a standard backpropagation algorithm to train the network efficiently. Efficiently. Let's take a look now at how this would impact image processing, how you would process images this way. So if we had just a small 100 by 100 pixel image, that would mean we'd have 10,000 values as our input in the first layer here, which 10,000 neurons, right? So then if we have a fully connected network, that means that we have our matrix of weights is then 10,000 squared, right? So 100 million weights per layer, which is quite a lot. And that's only a 100 pixel squared image. If we're talking about doing a 512 squared pixel image, you rapidly reach the point where you have too many values, and it's just not computationally reasonable to try and approach the problem. So the other issue that we have is if we're trying to do something like tomogram segmentation, or say we're trying to do particle picking, which I'll talk about later too, it doesn't really matter where the object is in the image. It's the shape of the object that you're interested in. So you'd like to have some sort of translational equivalence. If you're using a neural network structure like this, basically you have to train the network to recognize each feature here, and then to recognize that same feature here, and then recognize the same feature here. You have to replicate that concept all over the network many, many times. And that's one of the reasons why there's so many weights involved. Now, As deep learning has evolved over the last decade, a lot of new concepts have emerged. When you say deep learning, we're not just talking about one thing, we're actually talking about lots of different related concepts. So the concept of deep networks, which I just introduced, was sort of what really got the ball rolling. But there's also the concept of convolutional networks, which is what I'm going to get into in just a minute. There are concept of modules, which is breaking networks into small pieces, with the pieces having different responsibilities from the overall network. There are autoencoders, which I'll also mention briefly a little bit later, recursive networks, long-term, short-term memory. There's 10 or 12 of these different things. And these things can be combined in various ways. and they have completely different, they're each one is almost like its own discipline, right? So what I'm going to focus on today is primarily convolutional networks, and I'll mention a little bit about autoencoders, because those are the two concepts which are primarily being used in cryo-EM right now. Now, if you look at the structure of a convolutional neural network, it generally looks a lot simpler than the networks that you'd see in traditional deep learning papers. But that's deceptive. The simplicity isn't quite what it seems. So, for example, in this case, I only have 40 neurons in my network, and yet I'm doing image processing, or 40 neurons in each layer of my network, I should say. And of course, I've got the dot, dot, dot in here, so I'm only showing three of them. But the networks are fully connected, just like my example was before. Hang on, let me move this down a little so we don't... You'd think I should be able to see that close to myself, right? There we go. Okay. So the difference in a convolutional neural network is previously we had each neuron representing one value, one number. In a convolutional neural network, each neuron represents an entire image. So you have an entire image in each neuron. And additionally, as long as you're just using a purely convolutional network, each of those images can have arbitrary size. So you have a little image or a big image, it doesn't really matter. Okay? And then when you're propagating from one layer of the network to the next layer of the network, you're not multiplying the each value in the image by some other value, by some weight. You're actually convolving the image by a filter. Okay? So what we have at each layer, instead of a weight associated with each connection, is we have a kernel associated with each connection. And the kernel is something that's getting convolved with each of the images in that particular layer. So you're doing basically a filtration operation at each layer. And when you're training the network, what you're training is these little tiny image kernel images. So you have 40 different filters which are getting applied when we have these connections. Here at this layer, we have 40 neurons connecting to 40 neurons, or sorry, right here. We have 40 neurons connecting to 40 neurons, so we have 1,600 of these little convolution kernels. So we're filtering the image 1,600 different ways to propagate between these layers. Now there's another concept that's shown right here, this 2x2 max pooling layer. One of the problems that you run into with convolutional networks, if you look at the literature, typically when people are doing convolutional neural networks, their kernels are like 3x3 pixels or 5x5 pixels, because as you scale the size of those convolution kernels, the computation becomes larger and larger, large scales very quickly. This is one of the big innovations that Muyuan made, is he's using unusually large kernels. So if you want to do something like annotation of tomograms, you don't want to make the decision about whether something is a particular feature very locally. You want to make that feature over a fairly large region. Now there are two ways of approaching that. One way is to use a big kernel, which is not as often used. The other approach is to make the network really deep and to use a bunch of these max pooling layers. So what the max pooling layer does is basically it's downsampling. You're taking the image and you're downsampling it by two. So you make the image half as large. And once the image is half as large, then your kernel, which was maybe 4x4 pixels here, the same 4x4 pixel kernel is now covering twice as large an area, effectively, in the original tomogram. The problem when you do that, though, is then you lose localization accuracy. So if you downsample by two, and then you downsample by two, and then you downsample by two, suddenly you can only find where a feature is to plus or minus 8 pixels. So then there's the concept of taking your downsampled image and then upscaling it again, and you wind up with these very deep networks, which accomplish tasks fairly effectively, but they're extremely difficult to train. So we have opted to go for shallow networks rather than deep networks. So that's why I said shallow deep learning in my first slide. So we don't have a lot of layers in the network. The advantage of not having a lot of layers is that the networks are very easy to train. So we're not providing you with a pre-trained neural network when we do tomogram segmentation. So if you use voice recognition in Google or something like that, that's using a deep neural network. And it's a single deep neural network which has been trained to do voice recognition for anyone, regardless of who they are. And it's one network which is really good at doing some particular task. In this case, what we want to do is train networks on the fly to target different problems. And to do that effectively, we have to keep the networks relatively shallow. But we're using these fairly large kernels. Okay, so the goal here is we're going to have several networks for each problem. We're going to have each network is basically going to mimic a single human annotator, and it's going to identify a single feature in the tomogram. So if you want to identify 10 different features in the tomogram, what we're going to do is we're going to train 10 different networks, one for each feature, and then we compete the networks against each other to produce the final annotation. Okay? So that's, this is that concept, right? So we have our tomogram. We have, in this case, four different neural networks. Each neural network annotates a particular feature, and then these aren't just binary decisions. This isn't a mask. This is actually a probability value, more or less. So you can actually say, oh, in this voxel, it's most likely this feature, it's less likely to be this feature. So then you actually get some additional discrimination power out of the competition process. So here's just a summary of that process. So we start out with the tomogram. We're going to zoom in. We'll go to a single slice, and then we'll box out a region that contains some feature, in this case, microtubules. Okay, so we box out a region that contains some microtubules, then you manually annotate the microtubules within that little 64 by 64 pixel box. And then a whole bunch of those go into the neural network training, including some negative examples where you have no microtubules. And then what you're seeing there is the output of the neural network with fairly high contrast. And then we apply the neural network to the entire volume. And of course, this is thresholded, so you're not seeing some of the lower values in between. Then we can use this to do the segmentation. We can pull out the microtubules very nicely. Then we can pull out ribosomes, and we can pull out other features. Each of those is a separate network. Okay, so again, here's our PC12 cell. So here's an example of applying this to pulling out all four different features from the tomogram. Once we box out the microtubules, I have to point out that none of these tomograms were collected for subtomogram averaging. They were all collected for purposes of just looking at large-scale morphology and changes taking place within the cells and that sort of thing. So the angstrom per pixel, the sampling of these tomograms was pretty poor. So we're not going to get very high resolution out of any of these things, but at least it shows you that the annotation is working well. So if we pull out the microtubules, we can see the periodicity. We can actually see there's some interesting stuff going on inside the microtubules here. Daniela Nicastro has observed something similar recently as well. Here's a trypanosome, and in this case, we're going to pull out the ribosomes from the trypanosome, and we'll do subtomogram averaging, and you can compare to a similarly filtered ribosome from the EMDB. I will add, since there was a comment earlier about subtomogram averaging, EMAN2 has a per-particle, per-tilt CTF correction for subtomogram averaging now. And we have a new missing wedge-aware 3D alignment algorithm, which is extremely fast. So we did 6,300 cubed particles, the nuclear pore complexes, in less than 12 hours on a single workstation. So that's about 7 seconds per 300 cubed alignment. So it's a very, very fast algorithm. So that's not GPU-based. We previously had a GPU-based one, but this is about 10 times faster than that. Okay, here's another example. We've got cultured mouse neurons. Again, of course, the edge of the hole that you're seeing there is it's not the edge of the cell, it's the edge of the hole. We pulled out a variety of different things. So we've got ribosomes, we've got microtubules, we've got actin filaments, we've got something that looks like a chaperone. And we weren't trying to do this exhaustively. We were just, pulling out a variety of different things. Now, one thing you may notice, if you look carefully, is that the edge of the hole is getting annotated here in this particular case. And it looks like it's some sort of a cell membrane feature in general. Sometimes it looks like microtubules. Sometimes it looks like different things.
there is a solution to that problem, which is you train a network to recognize the edge of the hole. And then when you do the competitive process, then that will effectively get boxed out. We didn't do that intentionally in this case. You would see what happens. So this is where the competitive nature of the process comes into play and is important. So the more features you annotate, the more things you annotate, the more accurate your final annotation will be. Another example from cyanobacteria, where we've identified the virus particles inside the phage, which is in the process of being lysed right now. We can see carboxysomes. This is the thylakoid membrane pulled out from the cyanobacteria, and we've done some averaging on the light harvesting complex. This isn't real. The resolution wasn't good enough to really pull anything out, but it at least shows the periodicity that's present. Okay, so how would you go about using these tools? I showed the little example in the movie, but basically you need to select about 10 tiles from a representative tomogram. These are just 64 by 64 pixels, and then you need to draw whatever feature it is you want to annotate manually within each of those tiles. Note that this annotation process is working slice by slice. It's 2D, not 3D. There are reasons for that. If you go to 3D, the convolution kernel size has to be made much smaller, or it becomes completely computationally inefficient. I mean, it would take days to do the annotation if you really did a full 27 by 27 by 27 or something like that kernel. Also, due to the missing wedge, you don't actually get all that much information out of Z. So we have done some first steps where instead of just looking at a single slice, we look at a single slice plus two or three slices above and below it, and it actually makes very little improvement in the final annotation results. It actually works pretty effectively layer by layer. So you need to select about 10 tiles that have the feature that you're looking for, and then you pick about 100 tiles that contain other stuff. So the idea is to discriminate between the feature you're looking for and anything else that might be present in the tomogram, so you need to pick a bunch of examples. Now, these you don't have to annotate. You're just boxing out things that aren't what you're looking for. Then you train the network. It takes about 3 minutes. This does use GPU. And then you apply the networks to the tomogram. So for a 2K by 2K by 512 tomogram, it takes about an hour per feature to run the annotation. Currently, that's running on the CPU due to memory reasons, but we're working on an improved algorithm which will let it run on the GPU, and then it should be about 10 times faster. But anyway, this is a reasonable speed. I mean, a typical person trying to annotate a tomogram like this takes about a week to do it. So using this strategy, we can annotate 10 features in a day pretty easily. And most of that time isn't human effort. The human effort involved would be about 10, 15 minutes per feature. Okay, so now let me take a step backwards. So that's the automatic tomogram annotation that we've been using. One of the other papers I showed my list was by Min Zhu, who hasn't. This is in archive right now. I think he's trying to get it published, but it's not out yet. And he's not alone in making use of this autoencoder concept. Several of the other papers also are making use of this autoencoder concept. So this is one of the most interesting things that's emerged in deep learning in recent years, which is you can train neural networks to do basically reduced representations. Okay, so you put in some data here in Y, you propagate it through this network, and then the output also is Y. So you force the network, you train the network to have the same input as output. The goal of doing this is basically the same goal that we have when we use multivariate statistical analysis, principal component analysis, which is widely used in cryo-EM. So the conceptually, it's the same thing. The idea is you want to represent something that has a lot of noise and has a lot of very different variable features as with a small number of variables. So what happens here, basically, this is the input, this is the output, this is the reduced representation in the middle, you gradually contract things down to this point, and then you gradually expand it back out again. So basically, you've got a contraction process which is losing information, or hopefully losing noise, losing things that aren't information, and then you expand it back out again, and these are sort of the opposite of the things on the other side. So in the end, you wind up with something very similar to what you put in. And the idea here is that you don't have to have a human training the network. So when we're doing our subtomogram annotation stuff, someone has to tell you what each of the features are. So with something like this, you just put in all of the data, and then by the because the network is being forced to try and represent that information using a reduced number of variables, it basically identifies features that are common among all of the different inputs that you give it. So this concept is being used for subtomogram annotation in this paper here. And this is actually working fully in 3D. It's using much smaller kernels, but it's also invoking the autoencoder concept. So in our case, we're saying, okay, a human is going to identify features, and then we're going to manage to reproduce that on a lot of different tomograms. In this case, the idea is you're trying to have the neural network identify interesting things that might be present in the cell. So it's also a very interesting concept, but it's a very different concept. A similar sort of thing is being done in some of the single particle picking algorithms, other than the one that I'm going to show you that we did, where you don't have a human saying these are all particles. You just throw all everything from the micrograph in, and it will figure out what the particles are for you. Okay, so let me switch now to talking about particle picking using convolutional neural networks. So there is no perfect single particle picker. This dates back to Bridget's, you know, original particle picking challenge in the, you know, 2001 or 2 or something like that, a long, long time ago. Even if you have several humans pick particles from the same micrograph, they won't perfectly agree. Even if the particles are fairly easy, you won't have the humans agree, because if you have really dense particle populations, they may say, oh, I don't want to have particles that are touching, and someone else may say, oh, I do want to have particles that are touching. So it's very, very hard to come up with a consensus about that. We can use basically the same concept that we just invoked for subtomogram annotation, or for tomogram annotation, rather, for particle picking. The network structure is very similar. The difference in this case is, instead of having to draw an annotated curve for each feature that you're trying to access, basically, if you just box out a particle, the target function for the neural network is a Gaussian blob in the center of the box where the picked particle was. So basically, you train the network a similar way that you would train the previous network. You pick a bunch of particles, and then you pick a bunch of things that aren't particles, and then you train the network to discriminate between those two choices. This is what I was basically just saying. So in the tomogram segmentation, you had to draw the manual annotations in, and then the output like that. In the case of the particle picking, when there is a particle present in the box, you should have a Gaussian blob in the middle, and when there's no particle present, you should have nothing in the middle. Okay, seems to work reasonably well based on this. So let's look at an example. This is IP3 receptor. This was a very difficult data set to pick the particles for. If you try to use a reference-based auto-picker on this data set, I mean, we know roughly what IP3 receptor works, it's very difficult to pick a good threshold for it. If you pick a high enough threshold to get rid of all of these false positives in the background, then you lose a lot of the particles in the image. So this data set was actually completely manually picked, 2,500 some odd micrographs, 200,000 particles someone picked manually. Here's the reference-based auto-picker using projection. Oh, sorry, this was reference-based auto-picker using manually picked particles as references. This was reference-based auto-picker using projections of the 3D structure as a reference. This is what the convolutional neural network did, which looks not too bad. And then overlaid on that now is what the human did. So you can see there's very good agreement. It's not perfect, but very good agreement between the neural network and the human. Here's another problem that you run into. This is a problem for a lot of algorithms out there for automatic picking. If you have big blobs of ice contamination, very often they get picked as particles. It's difficult to come up with an algorithm which, at a reasonable threshold for the particles, will also exclude these things. There are some out there which do an okay job at it. Now, this problem, this was done with the neural network picker, and obviously it was a problem here. So we came up with a version 2 of the automatic picker, which can deal with that case and this case where you have aggregated particles. And the new strategy is we actually are training two different networks. So we have one network to discriminate between background, nothing, and the particles, and then we have another network which looks at the particles which came out of the first stage and tries to discriminate between them and junk. Okay. So now we're training three different categories of particles. We pick out background particles, we pick out bad stuff, and then we pick out good references, and note that we pick good references from a few good references from a bunch of different micrographs, so we get a range of different defocuses incorporated. So once we train the network to do this, now we get pretty nice results out. It avoids most of the ice contamination. We've got one little problem here, which is because there's actually a particle sitting on top of that ice contamination. You can train it against that. So I mean, if I said, oh, I don't want to include that, but the problem is then you might also exclude some of the particles in that view. So we tolerate a certain number of false positives still in the process. But in general, it does a very nice job. And we can get pretty good results. So I went ahead and I ran this on Sriram's 3.2 angstrom beta galactosidase data set which was just used in the modeling the map cryo-EM map challenge. So I ran it through that, and I got about 70,000 particles out. This is just a preview of something else. This is not neural network related. So we took the 70,000 particles and generated 256 classes, and using a new algorithm, which I've been trying to get working for about 20 years and is now actually working, took 8 minutes on a workstation to classify the 70,000 particles. Using the old approach in EMAN, it would have taken about 2 or 3 hours. And actually, these class averages are pretty nice. They have a lot of nice details in them. And the same strategy also can be used in 3D, and I managed to refine that to about 5 angstroms in 45 minutes and to 3.5 angstroms in about 3 hours, again, just using the CPU, not using any GPU. And the algorithm is pretty easily adaptable, I think, to the GPU as well. So this I think, may be a pretty important thing coming up over the next few months. It's working pretty well now, but I'm don't have time to talk about it in depth today. It would take a while. Here's just another example. This is the same class averaging strategy applied to proteasome particles, and you can see you get some pretty nice averages out here. These cases where you see shadowed particles, those are real. That's because the proteasomes are very dense in those images, so you're actually seeing cases where it's classified particles which are adjacent to other similar sorts of particles. Okay, now just a warning, if you want to experiment with any of this neural network stuff, EMAN 2.2 is currently using Theano, which is a neural networking software package, for doing all of the neural networks. If you just use CPU, if you don't use GPU, it's very slow to train. And if you want to use the GPU, you have to take an extra little step after installing EMAN, or it'll run on the CPU only. We're applying neural networks in a variety of other areas as well. I gave you two examples today, but we've also got a Gaussian mixture model, which is being used with an autoencoder to look at 3D dynamics based on the original 2D particles. We have a new missing wedge compensated subtopogram classification algorithm. One of the problems that you run into if you're trying to do subtomogram classification, so if you have a ribosome in this state and a ribosome in this state and a ribosome in this state, and you're trying to classify those, the missing wedge comes into that in a way that's very difficult to compensate for using traditional classification algorithms. If you run multivariate statistical analysis on it, it finds the wedge. It doesn't find the commonalities in the features. So it's actually much more difficult than it is in 2D classification. But using an autoencoder, we can actually train the network to ignore the missing wedge in a way that you couldn't do with the sort of linear approaches. So that's beginning to work pretty well as well. And we're also doing some stuff with dimensionality reduction, manifold generation, stuff like that for flexibility analysis using neural networks. So that is basically it.
We have some time for questions.
I was just curious, I suppose it didn't apply to your example tomograms because they were very large pixel sizes, but in general, might you expect that you'd have to train the nets for different sort of imaging conditions or different defocus or something like that?
It's pretty tolerant to different imaging conditions. If you're planning to try and segment a feature out of a set of 30 tomograms or something like that, it's a good idea to train it on examples from a few different tomograms to make sure it encompasses that range. But even if you just train it on one network, if you look at the paper that we just published, we actually have some examples of when that was done, but it's pretty tolerant.
I have a question for this training. So each new protein, I need to train it from beginning, or it can accumulate for different projects?
No, so each neural network is only representing a single feature. So when you're training a new feature, you're training a new network. Okay? So it's different than the approach. So if you try and make one big network, which would say annotate everything, you run into two problems. One, it takes forever to run. I mean, you can see even with these small networks that we're using here, these shallow networks we're using, it's still taking an hour or two to run on a decent computer. If we tried to make this deep, all-encompassing network, it would just be impractical to run right now. Now, that'll change moving forward. I mean, things will get faster. We've got these new chips coming out, which will do neural networking and hardware and stuff like that. So things will probably improve. But right now, it's not practical to really go that route. The other thing is, we don't have good training data. So let's say we wanted to train one network which would annotate any cell. We would have to have good representative features of all of the different, every possible feature from every possible cell to really do it. And one of the things you'll find, if you train a network on cyanobacteria and then you try to apply that network to find a similar feature in PC12 cells or something like that, that doesn't work all that well, because the texture of the data inside the cell, different types of cells, tends to be significantly different. The different other particles, which are part of the background, I guess you'd say, are going to be different in different cell types. So,
great. This is really exciting. So I have two questions. The first one is, once you have, for example, the microtubules and everything, you have this sort of probability networks. And how do you go from there to extract, for example, surfaces or microtubules or things like that? Do you do this manually right now, or is it already?
No, there's a program that'll do that. Right now, that program is in the, we have an examples folder where we put stuff that we're still kind of developing. So that program is in there right now. But basically, you just follow the peak, and you can for filaments, it will just box things along the path of the peak. For isolated objects like ribosomes and stuff, you just do single isolated.
And for surfaces, do you just map them?
Surfaces, we haven't done a whole lot with. I mean, the only thing was the thylakoid membrane example, and that was kind of a one-off. It's not really very challenging.
Right. No. Yeah. And the other one was, so now that you have all these probability maps for different features, I know it's easy to do, but do you already have a way to say, just find the highest feature and assign it to that, or is it something that would be done manually?
Oh no, that's done automatically. Yeah, once you have several networks, right, and then the process of competing them against each other to produce a single merged annotation, that's already done.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Hi, Steve. So I was sort of thinking, are these, up right here, I was sort of thinking, can these trained networks be banked and shared? Or are they tied to specific pixel sizes? Can you interpolate them? Or
interpolation works okay, but it's the same thing with like the particle picking problem. The networks are basically training on texture, on local texture, and if one person does a PC12 cell and someone else does a PC12 cell, the texture of the background is not usually going to come out to be all that similar. I can't give you a yes or no answer. It's a sometimes answer. You could bank them probably, but I think at this moment you'd have limited reproducibility from one lab to another. Within a project, it's fine, right? I mean, if you collect 30 tomograms of a particular type of cell in your own lab using similar sorts of conditions, then you can reuse it certainly within that project.
Great work. How does the algorithm behave with, I guess, higher noise or with different amounts of noise?
So there's a lot of filtration and downsampling going into this, since what you're doing is basically feature recognition. And basically, you're applying a whole bunch of filters. That's what you're training the network to do. So as long as discrimination is possible, you should be able to train the network to deal with it. I mean, it will automatically filter things, basically, to whatever extent is necessary. You can reach the case where you can't readily discriminate it, having an area of 30 by 30 pixels, which is what you get after downsampling. But if you can't discriminate it by the network, then you can't discriminate by eye either.
Can I?
Yeah.
I guess the question is then rephrased out.
Okay.
When does it become impossible to assign something?
Generally speaking, if you can see it to train the network, then the network will be able to do it too.
Steve, I perhaps a related question. These networks have many, many parameters that all need to be trained. So overfitting tends to be a problem, and there's many different solutions to that. I was wondering, what solutions do you employ to prevent overfitting the network?
So in this context, overfitting isn't really a problem. It basically means that you have some redundancy in the network. But it doesn't matter, because we're not trying to do anything else with the parameters per se. I'm saying it still gives you a good answer, even if it's ostensibly overfitted internally. This has been somewhat optimized. So, how big should the network be? Why do we have 40 neurons? Why don't we have 100 neurons? Why don't we have 20 neurons? This was optimized. Muyuan tried a whole all of these different types of cells and all the different types of features that he wanted to run to, and then he tested it with 100 neurons and with, he went all the way from like 5 to 200 or something like that. And it's kind of interesting. At about 40 neurons seems to be the sweet spot for doing tomogram annotation of one feature. But you can represent the same information with about 20 neurons. If you do 40, you can generally eliminate half of them and still get the same results. But if you start with 20, it doesn't work. It often doesn't converge. So basically, we deal with it by having tuned the system for the problem.